Acquisition number 17545, Reel 2.
Mr. Granfield, Reel 2.
Yeah, I was saying, I can remember the Birmingham, because she had one of the old walruses on there, and they used to fly her off and sling the crane over to pick her up. And the rumour was that she went out on patrol one day and she disappeared. Now, whether that was true, I don't know. But I can remember some of the troop ships in convoy. There was a Louis Pasteur, the Dilwara, and there was some of the... that's about all I can remember there. Anyway, then eventually we got into Durban on the Rangi Tartar, and we got off there, and they put us under canvas at a place called Clarewood, which was a racecourse just outside Durban. I think, speaking of, and we were there about a week, 10 days, and the people there were, you would have thought the war was over, because you would never believe how kind and generous they were. Apartheid apart, which I won't go into because I don't think that's anything to do with the story, but it was so prevalent in those days that we'd go into a park and you'd see a seat with Europeans, non-Europeans, and on the buses the same, exactly the same. But of course when we got into this camp in Durban, I mean the food was out of this world. I mean there was no blackout, there was no rationing. There was all the cigarettes you could buy in the world, Cape to Cairo, I always remember them. And we had everything done. Unfortunately, I had to go to a dentist when I was there and I have a tooth out, but that's by the by. And I think we were there for about a week to 10 days. But we used to go in the Durban one day and they announced over the ship's tannoy that people of Durban would like to meet you. And we just walked in there. And there was virtually hundreds of cars with the doors wide open. And you just stepped in and they would take you and entertain you. I can always remember, I went ashore there with £1.50, you know, 30 bob as they call it in those days. And I only spent 5 shillings all the time I was there. I remember my Dougie, my mate and Stan Charles. We went into this hotel one day, terrific place, walked across big army boots, you know, went into the bar, and for those that don't know it, but in those days there was a no treating law. In other words, you had to buy your own drink. You couldn't say, I went with me. I don't think they stuck to it really when the English troops was there. Dougie Cully for this right, and me and Stan Charles, we went into this place. And we went up to the bar, and we asked for 3 beers, and we was there talking. And eventually this gentleman came along, started talking about life on troop ship, how do you wash and all this sort of thing, which we used to use salt water. We used to have salt water soap. And I can remember poor Dougie Culliford. He was taken prisoner of war, but he died a few years ago. And he said, there's only one thing I miss, he said, I can't get my Gold Flake cigarettes, which most of us smoked, didn't they? And this chap didn't say anything. But he said, no, come on, he said, have a drink with me. So we drank up, and the barman slipped him a piece of paper, and he just signed it, you see. So to us, well, I couldn't figure out what it was all about. And he said, now, don't go away. I'll come back. And he came back. And he had a 200 boxes of Gold Flake cigarettes. And of course, the first thing we put our hands in our pocket, I wouldn't think of it. He said, you shared it amongst you. And then, of course, we said, well, have a drink with us. Oh, no, 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 he said. You have a drink with me, he said. And we had another, you know, each of us had a drink each. And he signed a slip of paper. And he said, well, I'm awfully sorry now, he said, but I've got to leave him now, and he wishes the best of luck and daddy die, you know. So after we went, we said to the bar chap, the other bar, he said, what's all this about like, you know? Well, he said he owned the place, don't he? He said, he's my boss. I said, no, I said, he was very generous. Oh, he said, all right, you know. But we, as I say, from there, and then we eventually left Durban, and we went on a ship called the Costa Rica, because The Rangi Tata, believe it or not, was a meat carrying fridge carrying ship, you know, refrigeration. And we heard after she was going over to South America to pick up meat to bring back to England. And we went on board this Costa Rica. And now she was a Dutch East Indies boat, and she'd just come over from the Dutch East Indies. And when we went on there, oh my God, she was absolutely filthy, it was. And I suppose to make it a bit worse, we had some RAF chaps with us, and of course they all had cabins. Well, we had just the decks and hammocks, you know, we slept there and lived the same on the Rangi Tata. You had your mess deck, and you slept up over, and you dreamt and everything there, apart from toilets. And, of course, that didn't go down very well, but it was filthy, really. And so anyway, we got on board the ship, and we had to be on board by 12 o'clock. We'd left our friends in Durban, that we'd met there, you know. And we decided, and this is true, we decided we'd walk off and make a protest about the state of the ship. And we lowered the gangway down about 2 o'clock in the morning. And there's quite a few of us, you know, but there was all Marines, by the way. And, of course, the officers got to hear it. And Major Maddox, he came down and he laid the law down to us, you know, but mutiny and all this sort of thing. In fact, they even called the Marines off. HMS Birmingham was tied up the stern of us. They called the Marines off up there, because I can remember seeing them. There was armour, their rifles, I suppose. Well, they thought we was going to cause trouble, I don't know, because we weren't armed. And anyway, he said, I know, you know, down here, this ship is not. He said, but look, I'll guarantee you this, he said, we'll have this ship clean from stem to stern. So we got on board and we slept on deck because it was warm, tropical nights, you know. And we did. He cleaned it. We had it cleaned, all right, and we done it. We scrubbed down the bulkheads and the hoist on the decks and all the rest of it. The only thing about it was, the food on there, after the Rangi Tata, was like a first-class hotel. Because she'd come from the East Indies somewhere, there's all fresh fruit on there and all sorts of things.
Were there any vermin in the ship?
No, not as I know of. It was just dilapidated, you know, and dirty. But I can't remember seeing any vermin at all on there. And then we went up through the, you know, up through Prince of Madagascar and up the Indian Ocean, up through the Red Sea, and you can tell that how they used to get air in through up the Red Sea, they would just put up a canvas chute and haul it up on the crane sort of thing, you know, and just this big, and just lower it down into the mess deck. And then we pulled into Port Suez. When we got to Port Suez, and then at the same time, this Greek campaign was coming to an end, and we went up through the Suez Canal then, because when we went abroad, we always had two kit bags, one wanted on voyage and the other one not wanted on voyage. So as we were going up through the Suez Canal, we was getting the kit up from out of the hold, you know. I can always remember somebody was cleaning a Lewis gun, and she hit a bit of a sandbar, and the Lewis gun went over the side. No, I don't know whether anybody knew anything about it. Nobody did. And then we got off at Port Said, eventually. Got our kit, went to a place called El Tahag, El Quasasin. We called it Flytown. There was so many flies. Flytown. There were that many flies down there. That was down on the canal, near Ismailia. And we were there. We were there one day, and the next thing we knew, Master said, "Oh, he said, we're moving from here." And I can remember him saying to me, I'm forgetting who the officer was, he said, "We're going to Crete." I said, "Oh," I said, I show my ignorance, I should have known, but I didn't. I had a fair education. "Oh," he said, "we're going to Crete." I said, "Where's that then?" He said, "Well, it's an island, Mediterranean." I said, "Any sand there?" And he said, "No, I don't think so." He said, "Oh, no." I said, "Well, that'd be better than this, because we were sand all over the place, you know, where we went." And then we got up to Port Said, and we went on a ship called the New Zealand, spelt the Dutch way, N-I-E-U-W-Z-E-A, like that, A-L-N-D. A battery, which was the anti-aircraft guns, they was on the city of Canterbury. We had a small convoy. I can't remember. We had a couple of destroyers. I don't know. I can't remember how many was in the convoy, but anyway, we got on board and that was it. And we were approaching Crete towards the evening, and we had all. I think it was about 40 Lewis guns mounted on tripods around the deck. I mean, because of the officers obviously knew we might be attacked by the air, from the air. And as we were approaching Crete in the semi-darkness, this Heinco 111 flew over. And I swear to this day that he never saw the con. He couldn't have done, because he came so low. And with that, all the guns opened up and went brrrr. And the next thing we saw him was going down the stern and dropping into the sea. I can remember somebody marking, I wonder if they'll stop, pick the pilot up. If we didn't know what was coming, he would have said that. But anyway, we arrived into Ceuta Bay, dead of night, about 3 o'clock in the morning it was, dark as a bay, and we got off at Ceuta, and there was a sort of a warehouse, for the want of a word, on the side that was dark, and I remember these army chaps, there was men in a Bofors gun on there, and they give us all a good, wish you a cheerio and all this sort of thing, what are you doing here? And of course, eventually we found out then that we were going to defend Ceuta Bay as an anchorage, because it was a marvellous harbour, and apparently it was done through Andrew Cunningham, the commander-in-chief of the Med Fleet, and our bloke. Incidentally, the chap in charge of there in BDO1, I never mentioned it before, but he was a Major General at Weston. Major General Weston, he was in charge of the whole MMBDO. I mean, it's a bit deorganized, because, we had searchlight regiment, two anti-aircraft regiment, they were using 3-inch guns, A, B, C, D batteries. We had coastal defense guns, Z battery, Devon battery, coastal defense searchlights. We had a boat unit. We had our own medical staff that was from the Navy, electricians. We had a landing and maintenance unit. I'm going to upset it, but it was the idea was we even had our own transport. I think she was called Mashuba or something like that. She was over in Haifa loading up the stores, which we never got anyway. And when we got to Crete, eventually we were going to take over from an army searchlight regiment, 27th, I think it was. Rather strange, one of the chaps of our branch, he was over there, taken prisoner, naturally. And but we never had any equipment again, and because then we were there, we'd been there a few days around Ceuta Bay, around that area underneath. We got off, and never had no tents or anything like that, we walked off, and the battery sergeant major, Hughes, old, and I think he was a reservist. He said, that's your tree, and we was allocated trees to sleep under, these olive trees, But anyway, the nights were nights and balmy, a bit cold at night. And then we'd been there, I don't know how long, I can't remember. And then we had this information that they were going to invade the island with paratroops, and that we used to stand by every morning at dawn and every evening at dusk for about an hour. So we knew they was coming. And of course, you read the history of Crete after, Freyberg knew from day one where they was coming and when. All he didn't know was the time, I think. And so, as I say, we never had equipment, so we just fought. We were just, our battery was just S Battalion infantry. But all we had was P-14 rifles and Lewis guns. We dug slit trenches, we'd done this and that. And then, this is my own personal story. I was with a chap called Corporal Challoner, from the Midlands. And they put us up into a ravine off Ceuta Bay, and when we got up, there was all this MMBDO stores. We had a, We had our own library. We was going, if we'd have been thinking, a static defence unit, as we were to defend the fleet at Anchorage, as they told us, we was going to have our own cinema. When we joined that, we all volunteered to pay a penny a week towards a sports fund, which would provide footballs, cricket bats, library books, a bit of a cinema and all this other thing, and we all paid that. And when we got up in this ravine, all these stores was up there, all in boxes and all this. I can remember the shield of a 4-inch gun up there, and a gun to the side, which hadn't been mounted, and various other things. And we were up in this ravine, and we'd been told, we used to stand to every morning and every night, and we stood to this morning. There was 9 of us up there, that's all. Chandler, Bill Chandler, myself, and 7 others, I can't remember who they were. We had our kit up there, dug into a hill, we'd flatten the ground so we'd have something decent to lie on. Our kit bags was all up there. And we looked out this morning, and prior to that, it was just hell, it was. They were machine gunning, bombing, you couldn't move on the ground at day. I mean, they was coming over, they used to have these fuselage torches, a sort of a reconnaissance plane up over. They would hover around, and they said, no, there's not this. And then, but of course, we know after that what they went for was for the guns, to take the guns out first, and then they was coming in after. And they got, well, they did, because the A battery, as I was telling you earlier on about Dennis O'Brien's husband, or Dan Carey, they was killed on the first day. And anyway, we looked out, and all of a sudden all the bombing stopped, which had been going on for days and days, and machine gunning. They'd come down, and the rear gunner would just fire a shot. And I mean, fortunately, there was a lot of trees over there, a lot of olive groves. And although they couldn't see us, I suppose, they didn't cause the casualties I thought they would have, at least what the Germans thought they would have, because they simply couldn't see what they was aiming at, because it was all woodland, And we was underneath the trees there, and this particular morning we looked up, and I said to Bill, I said, look at that, we seen these planes coming in, junk as 52s, And then after a bit, although we was told, we were still surprised, We saw these little dots coming out of them, All of a sudden you'd see the parachutes and move them before you could see Jack Robson, who was down on the ground. Now, I'll be honest, where we were then, we weren't near him. But within 2 or 3 hours, they sent us, battalion or battery headquarters, whatever they call it, and they sent up a runner. We had to go down. I forget this chap. He said, we've got bloody parachutes dropping all around us. He said, you can't miss them. And so we went down there and bit out to Souda Bay. And we got down there. Dave was on the ground. Without being heroic, we just cleaned them up, and that was that. Now, up on the...
How exactly did you do it? Can you give the details?
Well, you just found bloody rifle and just hope you did them, But after about the first day, we had no problem with them around the Souda Bay area. We'd knocked them all off. They'd knocked them off up on the Akatori Peninsula, which was another story. But of course, what we didn't know, that they'd run into trouble with the New Zealanders up at Malamy, up on the aerodrome up there. And then they decided to send us up there one night, and Captain Hammond, he was, I'm almost sure, he was, well, on orders when we were back in England, his name went up under the Right Honourable P.G.L. Hammond. Somebody told me his father was Lord Hammond, something to do with the dock board or something like that, I don't know. And we started taking supplies up there, or trying to help them come out, but it was dark, because the trouble is, you couldn't do nothing in the daylight, because they had air supply. I mean, they just, pinned on the ground. And after that, we just
This is at Malamy?
Up towards Malamy, went up there, and then the next thing we knew that, they weren't retreating, but the New Zealanders was coming back, and then, of course, then we realised, we were quite happy, we'd held them off, and there was no trouble. I mean, at the time, of course, we didn't know what was happening at Heraklion or down at Retimore, but the boys down in Heraklion, because we had some of the marine battery down there. I mean, they was having the time of their lives on there. They knocked nearly christened them, you know. I mean, no problem. And then we found that the New Zealanders and the few Australians that were there were starting to come back through. And of course, we wondered what's going on, like, you know. I mean, that's why we were just ordinary, run-of-the-mill soldiers, Marines, call us what you like. You know, we didn't know the strategy of the place. And we got then down to a place called 42nd Street. And it was I've been back there since with my mates, Mr. Rowlands from down Exeter, and a few more of us. And we've gone back to 42nd Street. And so I remember staying there. It was a bit of a sunken road. It called it 42nd Street because 42nd, apparently, Royal Engineers had been there before us. And they had to give it a name, something. Because, you see, and in those days, I mean, we never knew we were in Crete, but villages and things like that didn't mean a thing to us. I mean, it was only about a year ago, one of our Crete vets, we were at a meeting in Weston, that's where we meet, and he said to me, Jack, he said, I didn't know, he said, well, I didn't realise, he said, that Kandy, as they call it then, Harnia now, there was only just down the road. He said, we could go down there and have a booze up, couldn't us, like, you know, but we didn't know anything about it. I don't know, our officers had maps, I don't know. But anyway, that's beside the point. Anyway, so we done what we could with the pouches on the ground, and as I said, they started coming back through. And we were at 42nd Street, just south of Souda there. And we bumped up against them then, and we held them off. But then they started going round us, so somebody said, oh, well, we better retire. And before we knew we retired, I mean, it was really rude, didn't it? And then we were walking down, and I was with Corporal Challoner. We were coming down this bit of a road or a track. I mean, there was no roads over the natives. And all of a sudden, Jerry came down, you know, with his planes, and he started firing machine guns and bombing. And I dived to cover, and he went one way, and the raid finished, for want of a word. It just stopped. And I got up, and I looked around for Corporal Challoner. He was my corporal. I was his Landshark, I was. And I looked round for him, and I stood up, and I said, where are you, anybody? I've never seen him from that day to this. All I know, he was taking a prisoner of war, because I got photographs upstairs that a friend of mine from Liberty Gasbury sent to his mother, sent out to me, and that's how I got it. It was rather strange. To digress, you see, he was a heavy smoker. I smoke, but not very much. And he said one day, before the video started, he said, let us 20 fags, really. I said, yeah, he said, you can have them back when we get our ration. Yeah, I said, yeah. Well, I gave him me 20 fags, whatever they were. I've never had them back. Because if I met him, do you know the first thing I'd say to him? You owe me 20 cigarettes. But I've never been able to contact him, not through Crete Vets or anyone like that. You know, it's strange. So then we started... Well, retreating. We came back up through Souda, and we came back up over the mountains. I mean, I wasn't on, you know, there were troops of all sorts, soldiers, a few airmen in between. And like, I remember coming up one day, and I saw this Australian major. Obviously, he was an Aussie, but he's slouch at, you know. And I said to him, can you tell me what, I said, what's on, sir? I said, you. I said, I haven't got my units gone. I said, I don't know where they are. I was on my own on this occasion, just on me Jack Jones and me, just on me gear, me rifle, 50 rounds still, what was left of them, tin hat, overcoat, and pair of shorts, and me tunic. And I said, could you tell me? Well, he said, you got to go for a place called Sfark here. That's the first time I'd ever heard of it. They said, never knew, wasn't familiar with Crete. And I said, well, where is that then? He said, well, look, just keep going on. He said, follow the crowd. He said, in about 2 days' time, you might get there. And I thought, so, you know, I'm there. So I left him, and eventually we started kind of, I mean, it was just, there was no road, it was just tracks up, downhill. You get up one mountain, I mean, some of them was up, what, 3,000 metres, 3,000 feet up, some of them. You go up one lot, you go down another lot, and then you go up another lot, and I was going on. Of course, in the meantime, you was getting a bit sore on the foot. And this is another truth. I came across, there was a colour sergeant sat on the, well, just sort of on the hillside, you know, daylight it was. Planes had disappeared, and I could see he was a colour sergeant in the Marines. So I got up by him, you see, he was sat down there, I can see it, mind, he was a big, massive chap, he must have been 6 foot and 14 stone, because my mate in A Battery know quite a lot about him, because he was a regular, and he was their instructor, you know, when they joined up. Didn't have a lot of time for him, but then, as we say, the point. And he said, oh, Royal, he said, I was like, which is a familiar name in the services, you know, for call you Royal, right, if you don't hear your name. He said, oh, Royal, how are you? I said, my feet's been playing, yep, you know, just like that. And he said, have a drop of this. And he ended his water bottle, and I had my enamel mug, white enamel mug with me on my belt. And I took it off, and he went, gurgle, gurgle, gurgle. And I suppose, it was rum. No, I'd never seen rum over there. Where he got it from, I don't know, and I could not, well, at the moment I couldn't care less, because he said, you have a drop of this, and I suppose he put about inch or so on the bottom, or inch to 2 inches of rum on the bottom of my mug. Just like I've told my wife since, although, I mean, I didn't know her then. I said, I drank that down, and I was off like a mounting goat. My feet never hurt me until I got down to the... well, till I got in Egypt, actually, which is a bit in advance of it. So anyway, we started crawling along there. We came across an old... We never had a grub over there, any worth talking about, you know. To go back when they realised that we had, somebody went for bread, we had a pound loaf of bread between about 40 of us. We finished up with a piece about Oxo cube size. One chap went off with some tea one night. He was a Scotchman at Stammered. Another story. Finished up poor Varsha Suez Canal eventually. Took a commission. And he came back to me, and we was in this slit trench. I can hear him now. I wish I could imitate him. Scotchman that stutters. Do you want some of this? And he'd gone off, come and he got some tea. And I drank it. And he'd made it in a petrol can. He had, you know, stuck a stank of petrol. Anyway, that's to digress a bit. So we gets up on there, and then I came across these a couple of Australians, and I can see them now. They were sat there on the ground with their legs up like that, you know, up against a tree, their rifles at the side of them. And I said, oh, look, chap, I said, Jerry's just behind us here. I said, we could hear him later on. And, well, I mean, all they said, bugger him. He said, they chased us out of Greece. He said, they chased us out here, it's just too bad. He said, if they captured us, well, that's our hard luck, and I left them there. I don't know what happened to them. And then I came eventually across a bit of a food or food shop, and I can always remember it was this dried fruit that you see in the supermarkets, no? And it was dried, I don't know, it was dried pears or dried apricots, just dried, you know? And I stuck them in my ammunition pouches, and I chewed.